It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about an ancient city that was discovered here in the Midwest.
First, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld an earlier court's decision to block President Trump's controversial immigration and travel ban. The order was met with protests nationwide and court challenges almost immediately after its rollout.
The Trump administration argues that it is necessary for national security, while opponents have argued it prevented already vetted green card holders and refugees from entering the country legally.
Matt Ford joins us now to talk about the ruling. He's an associate editor at The Atlantic and has been covering this news. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's go through this three-judge panel ruling. What did we learn from yesterday's opinion?
Well, yesterday's opinion was quite a severe setback for the Trump administration in its legal battle over the executive order. The most important thing was that the temporary ban issued by a lower court judge on the executive order's enforcement will stay in effect for the immediate future. Because this decision was made by the Ninth Circuit, which is one of the federal courts of appeals, the only group that can overturn it is the Supreme Court.
And taking a look at arguments on both sides here, what were the arguments from the opponents to the ban?
Well, the states of Washington and Minnesota brought the lawsuit, and their claims were multiple. The most important one that they made was that it would severely affect their tax base and their economies by impairing the ability of their state's residents who were born outside of the country to travel back and forth into the country. They also claimed, in a more serious aspect of it, that the ban itself violated the 14th Amendment's protections on equal rights, as well as the First Amendment's prohibitions against discrimination on religious grounds.
And Justice Department attorneys argued the president's authority was, quote, unreviewable. Can you explain this?
Right. So the courts have traditionally granted the federal government very broad latitude on issues of immigration, on issues of foreign policy, and on issues of national security. Judges typically say that they're ill-equipped to make the sort of determinations that go into dealing with foreign countries. But in this case, the judges countered by noting that not only did they have the constitutional authority to review the decisions, but that the federal government itself had presented insufficient evidence to justify giving them the latitude they wanted on these national security determinations.
And what other things did the Trump administration argue to the panel in this?
Well, the Trump administration pointed to a federal statute that gives the president the authority to exclude classes of aliens that he may deem necessary to exclude on national security grounds for the safety of the United States. But the federal courts looked at this and they said that he has made an insufficient application, that this would justify lifting the executive order's injunction, the injunction against enforcing the executive order, rather, because of the injury that could result to the people caught up in it, international students traveling to public universities, for example. People who are applying to the refugee program would also be caught up in this. And because the injury to the plaintiffs in the case, to Washington and Minnesota, outweighed the impact for the federal government, they ruled in favor of the states.
Once this ruling came up, President Trump tweeted his displeasure at the decision, saying, "See you in court. The national security of our nation is at stake." What court are we talking about here? Where does this go?
That's a very good question. And the honest answer is we don't know yet. President Trump has multiple options he could pursue. The logical one would be to go to the Supreme Court and seek review there. But that has risks. The Supreme Court only has 8 members now, and if the court deadlocks in a 4-4 vote, the Ninth Circuit's ruling will be the final say on this part of the issue. Alternatively, he could go back to the lower court, where the judge issued the restraining order against him, and try and go to the merits of the case. The ruling that came out yesterday was on whether or not the restraining order should be left in place until those merits can be heard. If he believes that it's not a fruitful battle to fight the restraining order, he may seek to move on instead to fight the meat of the case itself and try and win on those grounds.
What did the court not consider in regards to this case? What were things that were left out of this decision?
Well, one of the most important aspects that the court declined to consider was whether or not this was discrimination on religious grounds. Now, this is a preliminary matter, so that doesn't mean they can't review it in the at a later hearing. But what the Ninth Circuit did was said that the states had already proven there would be enough injury to themselves on the basis of equal protection. So therefore, they reserved consideration of the religious discrimination grounds for later hearing. At the same time, they did note that President Trump and some of his associates had referred to this as a Muslim ban, and the courts can consider that as evidence of bias when determining whether or not a law is discriminatory.
We're talking with Matt Ford. He's an associate editor at The Atlantic, and he's been covering this news about the controversial immigration and travel ban. And as we heard yesterday, a ruling coming out from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld an earlier court's decision to block President Trump's travel ban. Matt, as you're following this, what are some of the takeaways before President Trump here as he goes forward? This is an early loss. Where do you see this going from here?
Well, this is an important loss for him because while other courts may decline to impose their own restraining orders, no other court other than the Supreme Court now can lift the one imposed by Judge Robart in Seattle. At the same time, we've also seen President Trump be willing to criticize the judiciary much more directly than many of his predecessors, and that raises the questions of whether he will continue to do so and whether or not he intends to perhaps even defy the court's orders.
And as this plays out in the days and weeks ahead, the Justice Department has said it is going back and reviewing this ruling. What are they looking at in particular about this three-judge panel opinion? What could they be stewing about?
Well, the most important aspect for them to consider is what arguments the court may have rejected of theirs and what arguments they didn't address. Now, the ones they didn't address was the religious discrimination grounds. And on that regard, that gives the federal government an advantage because it can go back to the lower court and say that, look, nobody has ruled yet on whether or not this constitutes religious discrimination one way or the other. At the same time, they also can retool some of their arguments based on what the court did rule against them. For example, on standing, the court did say that the states, because their higher education systems would be impacted by the executive order, they had standing to challenge it in court. Now, that gives the federal government an advantage because it can go back and say, well, you've given them grounds to challenge it on this, but you can also, by that, limit the impact that the state can have. For example, the state could only challenge those parts of the executive order that affect students on visas, for example, and leave intact parts that deal with, for example, Syrian refugees.
And this is a moving target. President Trump said even just in recent remarks here this afternoon that there will be something coming forth very soon about national security. What do you have your eye on?
Well, the most important thing that we'll have to look at with regard to this controversy is whether or not he'll draft another executive order to replace this one. On one hand, that could give him a chance to kind of iron out some of the constitutional and legal wrinkles that have arisen with his executive order. There have been lots of reports saying that this one was drafted pretty hastily, that it didn't go through sufficient review by the Justice Department before it was being issued. So if they go back and go through those processes, it could give them an advantage in defending another order in federal court in the future. But beyond that, we really don't know. The administration has been very opaque about what it intends to do on national security grounds, so it could either revisit this order or it could tackle another issue of national security.
Oh, we'll be watching. Matt, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Ford is an associate editor at The Atlantic. He joined us this afternoon to talk about the appeals court ruling, which upheld an earlier ruling barring President Trump's immigration order.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, a chef shares strategies and recipes for building a healthy gut a few million microbes at a time.
First, right here in the Midwest, we can find evidence of an ancient city that at its peak was larger than Paris or London at the time.
Although the city's actual name is unknown, it's now referred to as Cahokia. And if you find yourself in the St. Louis area, you can still see the ruins of what was once a massive ancient city.
And as we've heard here on Central Time, the influence of that culture spread here to Wisconsin in places like Ascalon and Trempealeau. Annalee Newitz joins us now. She's a tech culture editor at Ars Technica, and she wrote an article about her experience on an archaeological expedition last summer at Cahokia. Annalee, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about what we know about the people who built Cahokia.
So there's a lot of mysteries around these people, partly because they didn't leave any writing behind. So we don't know a lot about their everyday lives. And what we do know, we've learned from looking at this great city that they built about 1,000 years ago. And the city is so remarkable because even in, you know, the 17th and 18th century, when Europeans were first stumbling on it and describing it, it was clear that it had been this massive, massive place. And it was full of mounds and sort of the remains of pyramids. And we know that from looking at this extensive infrastructure of the city, that they had a very elaborate system of hierarchy. They had elite people. They had working people. They also were incredible farmers. In order to feed a city of maybe 30,000 people, which is quite big for the time, you really need to have extensive farms. And so we know that they were kind of geniuses at farming and agriculture and at shaping the waterways around the city to allow them to water all of their crops. So we know that they were city builders. We know that they had elaborate social structure. And we know a lot of things about their kind of art and representation. But we don't know much about, for example, what they called themselves.
And can you talk some about archaeology going on now to try to understand this more, including the project you participated in this summer?
Sure. So there is a lot of extensive work going on all the time. And of course, people are welcome to come out and visit the Cahokia Mound State Park in Illinois, and I highly recommend it.
Me too.
Go strolling through the don't go strolling through archaeological digs, because archaeologists get really sad when you do that. But every summer, which is basically dig season, because it's likely to be the most dry time of year, there might be anywhere from half a dozen to a dozen excavations going on, and people are looking for everything from clues about who these people were and where they went after they abandoned the city, to just learning more about their everyday lives and the kind of art that they created. Sometimes when these digs happen, you find really unexpected things. Like one of my favorite stories is a dig where a group was just trying to find out more about sort of ceremonies that happened near Monk's Mound, which is this enormous, flat-topped pyramid at the center of the city, which is quite awe-inspiring. It's about 100 feet high. And so they said, okay, there's got to be some, you know, cool stuff that happened near this giant pyramid. So they dug up a big pit, and they found the remains of a giant party. And it was just full of, like, barbecue remains and, like, broken dishes and all kinds of stuff that you bring to a party. And apparently, it still smelled bad after 1,000 years, because people had just dumped so much garbage and then covered it up. So the archaeologist kind of complained afterward that it was a little bit stinky down there.
Can you talk about the influence of this culture and its connections around the country? As I understand from your writing, one theory is that Cahokia was inspired by some things that were happening further to the east in terms of building. And as I mentioned, there are places in Wisconsin that show Cahokian influence, maybe Cahokian settlers along the Mississippi and elsewhere. This was part of a big scene here in North America.
Yeah, it's true. And the people, Cahokia was simply the biggest city of what's called now the Mississippian culture, which is basically just a term for a very vast medieval culture of Native Americans that tended to build mounds. And if you look at a map of the United States, there's so many places that are called like Mound City and Moundville, and they really are scattered all across the country. And some of these are connected to the Mississippian culture, which we do see evidence having possibly stretched up as far as Wisconsin. There's certain icons that pop up a lot in Mississippian culture of a hero called Red Horn. And there's some imagery in Wisconsin that seems to reflect that Red Horn hero story. Red Horn didn't actually have a horn. He had red hair that he kind of spiked up in the back, so it looked like a horn. But also the practice of building mounds, building these huge earth mounds and big earthen structures, actually goes back in the United States possibly as much as 5,000 years. We have evidence of mounds in Louisiana going back 5,000 years, some extensive mounds at a place called Poverty Point that are about 3,000 years old. So it's likely that the people in the Mississippian culture who built Cahokia and who spread outward along the Mississippi probably had seen these older mounds and said, hey, this is a really great way to build a civilization. Let's start building mounds ourselves. So they were part of a long tradition that had already existed.
One amazing theory that you write about, an idea that just as Cahokia was going to hit its peak, it sounds like, there was a massive supernova that was lighting up the sky for a long period of time, a theory that that may have somehow inspired people to settle there and make this thing bigger. Is that right?
Some people believe that that is the case. We have very solid evidence that Native Americans saw this supernova. There's at Chaco Canyon, which is the Pueblo site in the southwest. There's actually a picture of this supernova positioned exactly where it would have been near the moon. So we know that Cahokians and the Mississippians, like the Pueblo Indians, were very interested in astronomy. They were very influenced by astronomy. They looked at the stars. They had names for the constellations. So, you know, there is a really interesting parallel where this supernova happened right about 1,000 years ago, right around the time that Cahokia kind of exploded. It went from being a village to being this enormous, monumental city. So it's tempting to say that there might be a connection. We can't know for sure, but they definitely occurred very close to each other in time. And it wouldn't be surprising if the ruling elites in Cahokia said, you know, something about how this phenomenon, which would have lit up the sky, it would have just been incredibly bright for at least a month. They might have, you know, drawn some inspiration from it or led a revival movement that was inspired by it, which is, again, revival movements were very common among Native Americans and often inspired by celestial events.
Talking to Annalee Newitz, she's a tech culture editor for the online publication Ars Technica, looking at the history of Cahokia. She spent time this summer on an archaeological dig at this Midwestern big city for the time, about 1,000 years ago. Wondering about the site and how it's been affected over the years. We've got a caller who wonders if flooding over the centuries affected the site. You write about, you know, farming happened there. Other Native American groups historically settled after Cahokia itself collapsed. How much have we lost in Cahokia?
We've sadly lost a lot, and part of that is just because the Cahokians built with wood, and so a lot of their structures are just simply gone. We can see the post holes where wood was driven into the ground, which actually tells us quite a lot about where they built and what they built. But, just the natural process of, you know, how wood rots away. We've lost a lot of that. As for flooding, the area is prone to flooding all the time, and the Cahokians actually worked with floods and built ponds and built elevated walkways and kind of managed water within the city. So we don't have, there were theories for a while that the city had basically been destroyed by a flood, and that's why people left. But there have been researchers just over the past year who've taken soil samples looking for evidence of a flood, because floods leave behind like really clear signs, like a lot of silt in the geological record. And there's nothing like that. There's no big flood. But in the modern era, of course, people did farm on top of the site of Cahokia. And there was a suburb built on top of Cahokia, and there was actually a drive-in just right across the street from Monk's Mound. This enormous, beautiful pyramid was right next to a drive-in that was called Mound's Drive-In, so at least the drive-in kind of paid homage to the mound. But that has been all cleared away, and now it is public land, and you can go visit and see the beautiful remains of the city.
You mentioned that it doesn't look like flooding was responsible for the downfall of Cahokia, but clearly this is a rise and fall story that archaeologists are trying to decipher. What are some of the ideas about why this big, sprawling city has ceased to exist?
It's the central mystery of the city. we all want to know what made it fail, because it was so big and so successful for at least 200 or 300 years. So one of the theories now that I think is, or one of the hypotheses that I think is most likely, is unfortunately that it's really complicated. There were likely a series of droughts which would have really bitten into their ability to feed themselves and kind of prevented people from wanting to stay. The city started clearing out over the last 50 to 100 years of its existence. The population really was leaving. So maybe that was because of farming, problems with farming. The other thing that we see is that there's a lot of evidence of civil strife. The central part of the city where the large mounds are and where they had a large public meeting area that's called the plaza, that area had been the site of a lot of public rituals. But then in like the last 100 years of the city's life, the people living there built a huge fence around it as if they were trying to defend themselves from other people in the city. They basically built kind of a walled community in the downtown area. And then after this fence is built, we start to see people throwing their trash into this area that had once been this really exalted downtown place. And so it seems like there was a kind of change in people's relationship to the elites who had been running the city, and that they may have attacked them. There may have been kind of the medieval equivalent of protests, and that kind of the power structure in the city really flipped around, and people started living really differently. So it's probably a combination of problems with drought and social changes.
Briefly, Annalee, you were digging there this summer. Are you going to go back?
I am. I'm going back this summer to find out more. It was a really exciting dig. The archaeologists found a lot of stuff they didn't expect, and probably this summer we're going to learn even more.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Annalee Newitz. She's the tech culture editor at Ars Technica. We've been learning about the ancient lost city of Cahokia. By the way, head over to the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a link to her full article. A lot of interesting information there.
Coming up after the news, a chef who's also a health coach shares how to build a healthy digestive system while enjoying great-tasting food. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we'll find out what Governor Walker's budget could mean for mental health care for children. That's part of our weekly roundup of Wisconsin news.
First, it's Food Friday. The microbiome is one of the big buzzwords of the moment, with a lot of attention to positive bacteria and other microorganisms that live inside us and help us out. But it's not always clear how can we help those good guys out.
Research shows that both physical health and mental well-being depend on the health of the gut and the microbes that live in it. And our next guest says it's not too difficult to create the right environment for them.
Pete Evans is an Australian chef, restaurateur, television presenter, and health coach, and he's the co-author with Helen Patterin of The Complete Gut Health Cookbook, everything you need to know about the gut and how to improve yours. He joins us now. Pete, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we talk to a lot of chefs and cooks on Food Friday, Pete. We don't always talk about how the food interacts with our gut. Why is that important for you as a chef to focus on?
Well, I think it's the most probably important thing that we should be talking about, especially for chefs that are cooking other people's food. I mean, it goes without saying that food is medicine, and the food that we eat is either going to create health or keep us in a healthy state, or create sickness. I mean, it is as simple as that. And I think a lot of people either do not want to swallow that part of the pun, but it really is that simple. So, I'm surprised that there's not more chefs that are promoting this way of life, because I feel it's our responsibility as people that cook food for other people that we need to take this seriously.
Well, Pete, we don't have a direct line to our gut to tell us exactly how we're doing. How can you tell if you have a healthy mix of bacteria or not in your gut?
Well, in actual fact, we do have a direct line. There's no more direct line than how we're feeling on a day-to-day basis. All you need to do is look at the mirror, see how your appearance is, feel how you're feeling each and every day. Do you wake up with energy? That should be your first and foremost indicator that something is out of whack. Of course, food is important, but we need to look at sleeping patterns, how we move, are we getting enough sunshine or vitamin D, what are our thought processes like, do we have healthy emotional relationships, removing stress out of our lives, all of these things. But definitely food is the one thing we can have the ability to change each and every day, except if you're a child and you're being fed by your parents, or if you're sick or perhaps elderly, or you don't have the capacity to cook for yourself. And then hopefully the people that are cooking for you know what they're bloody doing. So to go back, we definitely do have a direct connection with our guts. And this is what's so fascinating about this subject. We've got the science now that says that what we eat, we actually have 80% of our immune system in our guts. And we also have so many, brain cells, but serotonin resides in our gut.
Like a lot of hormones,
so,
right? Yeah.
Yeah, so basically what we're eating will have a direct response on how we feel, both mentally and also emotionally and also physically. But it's amazing that the emotional, the mental, is very often overlooked. And we're seeing amazing research at the moment with especially dairy and grains, for instance, especially gluten-containing grains, that they can affect how we feel on a day-to-day basis. So we're talking about depression, anxiety, mood swings, irritability, and that goes into sleep patterns and a whole lot of other things. So, we do have a direct connection.
We're talking to Pete Evans. His new cookbook is The Complete Gut Health Cookbook, everything you need to know about the gut and how to improve yours. Pete, what is the good stuff that you're wanting to cook with? Spell out some of the main ingredients of this gut-healthier diet.
Really, basically, what we're promoting here is an anti-inflammatory diet. Now, the most common foods or food groups that cause gut inflammation or body inflammation have been shown time and time again that dairy, for instance, and also grains, especially grains, these two food groups, if you want to take them out of your diet for the rest of your life, is what I would recommend, and then stick to the basics. Stick to abundant, colourful, organic vegetables, or homegrown if you've got the capacity to grow as many as you can. So fill the plate with vegetables, and then have a side serving of well-sourced seafood or meat. What do I mean by well-sourced? I mean, find an animal that has actually had the luxury of having a natural diet of what they've evolved to eat. So I'll say that again, an abundance of beautiful, colourful vegetables, low-carb variety in a greater ratio than the higher-carb variety, and then a side serving of well-sourced seafood or meat, including the good quality fats. And if you can stick to that for your breakfast, for your lunch, for your dinner, generally after about 4 to 6 weeks, you'll probably only have to eat 2 meals a day of this, because you're going to be getting all the nutrients you need, whereas we live in a society where, with the current Western-style diet, most people are eating 3 to 5 meals a day or snacking between them, and they're wondering why they're never getting satisfied. And because, again, research shows that the Western-style diet is 70% refined or starchy carbohydrates. We're teaching ourselves to be constantly hungry and searching for food. So
Once we eliminate the most common inflammatory foods, we fill the plate with those vegetables and a side serving of meat or seafood. That basically is the gut healthy protocol. Now, there's two other things we add to that if you want to take it a step further. And the first one is fermented foods or probiotics. A lot of people are buying probiotics that basically do nothing. You're making some manufacturer quite rich, and it has very little bearing on your gut microbiome, even though they're selling it as that. But if you learn how to make your own fermented probiotic foods, such as sauerkraut or kimchi or even some beverages, number one, you're going to save a lot of money. Number two, it's actually delicious. And number three, it actually does something for you, and because you're eating it in a whole food form. So, for instance, sauerkraut or kimchi, we know these foods are very ancient and they're very easy to make. And I think we're going to talk about a recipe later on. So once you eat that, you're getting a prebiotic and a probiotic in a very cheap whole food form that's very bioavailable for us. And you'll be amazed at the research that's coming out about this. And so the second thing that we like to add is the simple process of enjoying some broth made from the bones of animals, whether it's from the sea animals or land-based animals. Basically, we're making a soup, and we're going to incorporate that, a cup of that, into our diet each and every day. Now, that's really simple, because if you think about it, all cultures around the world or the globe have some form of animal-based bone broth soup. And we know that bone broth is so good for us because it's got collagen, it's got gelatin, it's got glucosamine, it's got the building blocks that we love. And basically what that does is it helps to heal up the gut from any long-term chronic Western-style diet's effects, because it's got these building blocks that our guts love. And then with the addition of the probiotic vegetables, for instance, the krauts, that helps to colonize the gut with the good, healthy bacteria. And once you're eating, once you've removed those common inflammatory triggers, the dairy and the grains, what you're left with is those beautiful foods that just nourish us. So after about 3 to 4 weeks of doing this, your gut starts to get on top of what it's meant to do, which is actually to absorb the nutrients from the food. And then you're on your way to a happy and healthy lifestyle.
Pete, where would you suggest people start in their kitchen if they want to go step by step here and take it a little bit slow? What would be a good first step in changing their kitchen and starting this healthy healthy digestive course, if you will?
I'd go back to basics. I mean, we've all heard of meat and three vegetables. And there's a reason why that is so popular. One is because it's so easy. And number two, it's basically how our great-grandparents and their great-grandparents would always eat. There'd always be some sort of meat on the table or seafood, and there'd always be some sort of vegetables that they would have got from the markets. So if we take it back to, say, the simple meat and three veg, but I would probably remove the potatoes because they're not really nutritious for us, and replace the potatoes with some broccoli or some kale or some silver beet, some cucumber or some tomatoes or some cauliflower or some whatever it may be that's beautiful and colourful that you can get from your local market or supermarket or grow yourself. I really can't make it any more simpler than maybe having some sort of meat and three veg, and the meat can be a piece of fish, or it could be some shrimp, or it could be some mussels, or it could be some lobster or crab, and I know that's pretty expensive and out there, but maybe even just a simple piece of Atlantic salmon, and then add to that some beautiful vegetables or a type of salad, if you like. I mean, it can be as simple as cooking a piece of fish and then having a cucumber salad on the side with some avocado, maybe. It would be very, very simple to do that on a day-to-day basis. You could cook some beautiful sausages. You could cook some beautiful, have a roast once a week. And then from that roast, say a roast chicken, you can use the bones from that to make your broth. It's really, really simple. So just go back to basics. And of course, you can include eggs into this because it's a good quality source of protein and fat. And with the eggs itself, if you're not intolerant to them, put them into your breakfast, but add some vegetables to it. And also a little bit of meat, if you like. So just go back to meat and three veg and eggs, if you like.
We're talking with chef and health coach Pete Evans about the tips and recipes in his book, The Complete Gut Health Cookbook.
We'll check out a couple recipes in a few moments, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for a guest about the diet he's recommending here to cultivate friendly gut bacteria? Have you tried to change your diet with these things in mind? And do you eat fermented foods? Do you make your own fermented foods at home? Do you have some sauerkraut brewing right now? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about cultivating a healthy digestive system and the foods that help support it.
And we'd like to hear from you on this Food Friday at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Have you tried eating more fermented or other microbe-rich foods? What results are you seeing? Have you found some favorites? What would you like to ask our guest about how food helps create a healthy gut and overall well-being? Maybe get some cooking advice while you're there. Call 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or go to our Facebook page and find a couple recipes.
Pete Evans stays with us. He's an Australian chef, restaurateur, and health coach. He's the co-author of The Complete Gut Health Cookbook. Pete, let's get into classic kimchi. What do you love about this recipe?
Oh, I mean, as a chef, it just ticks all the boxes. From a health point of view, it also ticks the boxes. So we're seeing a resurgence in these types of foods, especially in the top-end restaurants around the world. I host a TV series in the US called Movable Feast, which is on PBS, and also one in Australia, and we're seeing these fermented foods really coming back into fashion. So kimchi, for instance, it's basically cabbage and salt is the base of most fermented vegetables, actually. And then all you do is add your spice. And your spice that you add, basically, you pick the culture or the cuisine that you love, and then you flavor accordingly. So for beautiful traditional Korean kimchi, for instance, we might add some Korean chili powder into that, organic always, if you're going to be using any type of chilies. And then you can add some ginger, some grated ginger into that. You could also add a little bit of garlic if you choose to, some turmeric, which we know has great antibacterial properties and anti-inflammatory properties. To that as well, you could add some daikon or white radish, which is very popular in Japanese and also different Asian cultures. And then some grated carrot as well to give it some beta-carotene, and also maybe even some cucumber as well. I mean, I've seen it done so many different ways. And from that, basically, by using cabbage and salt as the starting point, when you massage your cabbage with the salt, the cabbage already has this wonderful organic bacteria on it. Now, what happens with this wonderful process of fermenting? Basically, you massage the cabbage with some salt, and the recipe you're going to share with your listeners, you start the breaking down process of the cellular fibers in the cabbage. And what happens is the liquid is reduced, or the water is reduced from the cabbage. And then after a while, basically, you get this really nutrient-rich sort of vegetable broth that's happening with your hands. And then what we do is put it into a glass jar, and we make sure that it is submerged under its own juice, so to speak, with the different spices if you want to spice it up, as I mentioned. And then you leave it in a room temperature place with a lid on. You can get special fermenting jars, if you like, off the internet. Otherwise, you just use a really good, clean, sterile glass jar always. You never use plastic, because the lactic acid bacteria that you're creating in there can leach the toxic plastic chemicals from the plastic, which you don't want in your food. So always do glass or some sort of earthenware crock. And then every day for the week, just crack the top of the lid just to let the CO2 release, or the build-up of the gas release. But you don't want any outside oxygen to get in, because it's in an anaerobic situation. Mm-hmm. I think that's the right terminology. I always get anaerobic and aerobic mixed up, but you don't want any oxygen in there. And then after about 7 to 10 days, depending on how hot your room temperature is, you should have a really nice sort of tart, sour, salty, beautiful condiment that you add to the side of your vegetables and meat on your plate. And that adds, as another form of vegetables getting into your diet, but it's a powerhouse of probiotic goodness. Now, your gut bacteria loves this stuff, and it's just, I don't know how to explain it, but put it this way, myself and my family and people that are eating this way, eat it with every meal. So we basically start off with, for a regular adult, you might start off with half a teaspoon until your guts get used to it, and then you might build up to maybe a tablespoon or two of this per meal per day, and it becomes something that you sort of, you get a little bit of addicted to, because we have this this funny thing in the Western-style diet where we're addicted to sugary, sweet carbohydrates, whereas in actual fact, once you remove them and you start putting in bitter, sour, astringent foods, you actually start to crave these foods because your body actually loves it. And it's a really great way to get off any sugar addiction or any carb craving that you have.
And we've got a recipe for that kimchi on the Central Time Facebook page, talking to Pete Evans about his book, The Complete Gut Health Cookbook. And I want to get to some of our callers, Pete. AJ is on the line in Columbus. AJ, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to ask about, AJ?
Oh, I wanted to ask your guest about kombucha, because I've heard that
Beautiful.
It's really great for your gut health as well. So I just wanted to hear his comment about that.
AJ, thanks. And kombucha, it's a fermented beverage, right, Pete?
Yeah, it's a fermented tea that basically originated, I think it was in China, and then it migrated through Russia and different parts of the world. And I know in the States, you've got some great kombuchas on the shelves themselves. But I'd always recommend, if you can, start making your own, because the stuff on the shelves you might see has a high sugar content. So kombucha I always look at as basically like a tonic or a medicinal addition to your regular diet. A lot of people think there's a magic pill out there that if they have the kombucha or every day they have their apple cider vinegar, they can continue to eat a Western-style diet and everything's hunky-dory, which is not actually the case. What I would recommend is going back to that basic formula of the vegetables with a side of seafood or meat and add some good quality filtered water that's fluoride-free and chlorine-free as well, and then add in these medicinal or tonics, herbal tonics, such as kombucha, which is a fermented tea and really easy to make and really cheap. And then you've also got these other wonderful probiotic beverages called kefirs or kefirs. And you get a dairy-free version of that, and they're really easy to make at home as well. And then you have maybe an ounce or two of that per day, and it just gives another different beneficial strains of bacteria into your diet. But I can't emphasize enough that good quality, clean drinking water is your go-to with a little additional side of these tonics.
Well, thank you, AJ, for your call. Let's go to Kara now in La Crosse. Hi, Kara.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question, everything that you're saying sounds wonderful. My only thought is I have a 12-year-old daughter who is very much so on the thin side, and I'm trying to come up with some healthy options, healthy calories for her, and it doesn't sound like vegetables have a lot of calories, and so I'm just wondering what your advice would be for me on that.
Sure. So, and don't take this the wrong way, but if you're counting calories generally, you've got the wrong information. So if you're eating a nutrient-rich diet, you should never have to count calories. So as a father of two daughters myself, one is 12 and one is 10, this is how we eat. And they're lean, but they're very athletic. I mean, yesterday my daughter ran and competed in six different swimming carnival races. Then we went surfing after that. And today I've just dropped her off at dancing for the next 4 hours. So they're very active children, but they are quite lean. But I'll give you an example of his breakfast today. I just cooked her breakfast about an hour ago because I'm calling from Australia here. So she had three eggs plus a little bit of really good pasture-raised bacon on the side. And we also had some collard greens, or what you might call, that have grown in the garden, and a little bit of avocado on the plate and some fresh herbs and that sauerkraut that we talk about. So the kids eat this at every meal. So if you're worried about your children being underweight, or it's hard for me to say unless we've done the proper tests, but if you're feeding them good quality fats in the form of animal fats that come from healthy animals, from land or sea, if you're also including eggs if they can tolerate it, and other forms of fat such as avocados, olives, coconuts, nuts and seeds if your daughter or children can tolerate them as well, and then going back to that lower carbohydrate approach of good quality vegetables, and then protein on the side of that. Now, I just have to stipulate this, that children, breastfeeding women and also pregnant women need to up their protein intake than being a small side serve on the side. So children need good quality protein. They also need great quality fats as well. So don't be scared to put an extra skewer of meat on the plate, or an extra sausage on the plate, or an extra piece of fish, or whatever it may be.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Pete Evans for joining us today. He's a chef, restaurateur, and health coach. We've been talking about the book he just co-authored. It's called The Complete Gut Health Cookbook. You can find, by the way, a couple of recipes on the Central Time Facebook page, the classic kimchi if you want to try some fermenting at home. And he also had a cabbage bacon soup. This is great for, well, winter here. Not winter in Australia right now.
Not winter in Australia right now.
But cabbage bacon soup. This is one I think I might try making. Also some of his broths. Are you going to ferment at home?
I don't ferment, but I do eat kimchi.
All right. I like it in small doses, like he was saying.
Our neighbors to the south are getting ready for an invasion of zombies.
The Illinois State Legislature advanced a plan to declare October as Zombie Preparedness Month and encourage people to take precautions against a zombie disaster.
But hold on here, Rob. Illinois state lawmakers aren't worried about an actual zombie invasion. The declaration is part of an effort to get people ready for natural disasters, not supernatural ones. Supporters are saying using zombies as conversation starters to get people to think about preparing for floods and tornadoes and other disasters.
And to get people to have their first aid kits, backup food and medicine plans, and, you know the evacuation routes in case of emergency.
Here's quoting from the resolution, whereas if the citizens of Illinois are prepared for zombies, they are prepared for any natural disaster. While a zombie apocalypse may never happen, the preparation for such an event is the same as for any natural disaster.
We had Max Brooks on the show. He's the author of World War Z. This is some years back. And he said his book isn't really about zombies. It's about how people react to disaster. So there's something to this in Illinois.
There is, although zombies may never get through toll roads, so they don't have to
worry
about that.
Auto pass for zombies. This is Central Time.